On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
If you've heard anything about the flyers of World War II, you might have heard about the Flying Tigers. And if you know anything about the Flying Tigers, you know that these were volunteers, American pilots, who were hired to fly for China's Air Force against the invading Japanese. Whatever happened, the guys who went down for the Tigers, they didn't land safely. And there was a relatively high attrition rate because they were a very small Air Force going up against a very aggressive Air Force. And part of the situation was the type of airplanes that they had and the type that the Japanese had. So to talk to us about that, Daniel Jackson, graduate of the Air Force Academy, the author of The Forgotten Squadron, the 449th Fighter Squadron of World War II, and Famine, Sword, and Fire, The Liberation of Southwest China in World War II, as well as his brand new book, Fallen Tigers, The Fate of America's Missing Airmen in China During World War II. It's a Mitchell Institute book, Aviation and Air Power series. The editor of the series is Brian Lassley, and it's from the University Press of Kentucky.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So what got you interested? Obviously, you're somebody who knows about pilots, knows about air forces, but what got you specifically interested in the Flying Tigers?
Well, Dave, when I was a cadet at the Air Force Academy, I was a history major there, and for one of my classes, I had the opportunity to interview John Allison, who was one of the great aces of World War II, who flew in China as a fighter pilot and then was one of the founders of the First Air Commando Group. And he really got me plugged into this network of veterans that still existed at the time in the 14th Air Force Association. And I got to meet a lot of them and talk to a lot of them and interview a lot of them about their experiences during the war when I was a cadet and then on. And I did not come. I was at the Air Force Academy. I graduated. I went to pilot training, et cetera. But I did not come from a military family. In fact, you got to go back all the way to the American Civil War to find any military in my family. And I was really lucky in that several of these veterans who I interviewed just took an active interest in my career and kind of took it upon themselves to mentor me in a way that I didn't have that available in my family. And so I felt this obligation, if you will, to tell their stories as they had told them to me and kind of preserve that heritage that they'd lived, especially since a lot of them, you know, beyond just the American Volunteer Group, you have the China Air Task Force and the 14th Air Force that kept the fight on in China throughout the war. And when you get beyond the American Volunteer Group, a lot of times it passes outside of what's known in popular history. And so a lot of their stories were just untold. A lot of really fascinating, exciting, and interesting stories just went completely untold. So I felt that obligation, and that's been the topic of all three of my books so far. For this most recent one, it was just really fascinating. One of the things about the China-Burma-India theater is that it's very anecdotal and very partisan in a lot of its coverage. You've got people that are pro-Stilwell, people that are pro-Chenault, people that are, you know, anti-Chiang Kai-shek and pro-Mao Zedong. You know, you got all these different partisan angles to it and this very anecdotal nature to it. And so I thought it'd be very interesting to look systematically at the aggregate of all these guys that went down, all these American air crew that went down on combat missions, and what happened to them, you know, why they went down, and then whether they were killed, captured, missing, or rescued afterwards, and try and get a non-anecdotal, more systematic look at what happened. And it really ended up being fascinating. There were a lot of surprising results from that study that formed the basis of the Fallen Tigers book.
How many Americans flew for the Chinese Air Force prior to the United States entry into World War II? How many flew after we got involved and there were efforts to consolidate them, weren't there?
Well, so the original American Volunteer Group, which was actually that idea was formulated in the fall of 1940 after the Japanese debuted their Zero fighter over Chongqing and just decimated the Chinese defending fighters. The Chinese were flying Russian-built I-15 and I-16 airplanes at the time, and they just didn't stand a chance against the new A-6M-0. And so Chiang Kai-shek sent Claire Chenault, who's a retired Air Corps captain, to the United States to basically pitch this idea of a volunteer group of experienced fighter pilots from the Army Air Forces, the Navy, and the Marine Corps, and group of 100 modern fighter planes with about 200 support personnel. And Schnell didn't think that anybody would buy off on this idea, but to his surprise, Roosevelt thought it was a great idea. He thought having a volunteer group of American aviators would be deniable, since it wouldn't be a military outfit,
right,
but still serve to help deter further Japanese aggression in the Far East. And so they ended up showing up in Burma in 1941 and get trained up by Schnell, who's been watching the Japanese fight for years. And they are just getting up to combat status when Pearl Harbor happens and end up already in place and do an incredible job compared to Army Air Force units that are fighting in, say, the Philippines. They lose 12 aircraft in air-to-air combat and 29 to other causes like ground fire or accidents. The Army Air Force in the Philippines loses 66 fighters in the first 3 days of the war and manages to shoot down about 30 Japanese planes before Bataan falls, while the AVG ends up shooting down, they claim 297, and even the most conservative estimates say at least 115. They end up folding up that unit in July of 1942. The powers that be were, first of all, really embarrassed that a volunteer outfit was outshining all of the U.S. military outfits, but then also had some legal objection to the volunteers being out there now that the United States was formally at war. And so they end up replacing it with the China Air Task Force, and then about 9 months later with the 14th Army Air Force. So we go from 100 T-40s, or the Hawk 81A2, the export model of the P-40, and 100 pilots and 200 ground crew. And by, there's no definitive number of how many Americans served in the year, but by May of 1944, there are about 1,600 air crews. That includes single-engine fighters and reconnaissance planes, single-seat fighters and reconnaissance planes, and bomber and transport crews of anywhere from 3 to 14 men. So you're talking thousands and thousands by 1944 that are cycling through there.
I think one of the things that I got to be honest about this, I'm not a big fan of General Stilwell, not just in the Burma-China theater, but also later on in China and later on in the Korean War. It just seems like he's more concerned about how well he looks to his bosses than how effective things are going, because he's determined to follow one course of action, which puts him in direct conflict with Chenault for a major portion of the war in this theater, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'll tell you what, because I didn't want to take a partisan view to this, I really tried to look at what were the effects of these individuals' actions. And I'll tell you, it was a bigger deal than the fact that Stilwell was at odds with Chenault, because Chenault had some fault in that as well. Stilwell
sure.
was his superior, and he went around him on a number of occasions. What I will say is that the biggest deal was that Stilwell could not get on the same page as Chiang Kai-shek. Mm-hmm. And this is at the same time that you've got Eisenhower in North Africa and Europe, who's very effectively being a diplomat and a soldier, building coalitions to fight the Germans. And Stilwell just doesn't have it in him. He's a good battlefield general, but he cannot build a coalition. He is just too much of a crotchety old infantryman, and he can't get along with people. And so, really, we see a hobbled Chinese-American alliance because of Stilwell's personality. And I think that was his biggest drawback. He was right about some things, but it doesn't matter if you're right and you go about it the wrong way. Chenault, on the other hand, was wrong about some things, but worked much better with the Chinese and had a much better outlook of how to pursue the war in a way that would keep China engaged and keep China's morale up and keep the Japanese, about a million Japanese troops stuck in the country, than Stilwell's idea. So they both had their strengths and weaknesses, and really the sad thing is that if they'd worked together, they could have been very effective in partnership, but in conflict they just brought everybody down.
There were some pretty significant operations that Chenault was trying to put together. And the problem with him continued to be support as far as replacement airplanes, upgraded airplanes, and so forth, correct?
That was a problem. I would say the number one problem for him was logistics. He could get newer and newer planes, but it was still hard to keep them going with spare parts and fuel when all of those spare parts and fuel had to be flown over the hump So logistics was always going to be the number one thing that held him back. So there's always going to be a limit to the number of airplanes that he could have in country due to logistics. I think the other problem with Chenault is that he was a big air power apostle and kind of bit off more than he could chew. And that's where you see in the Ichigo offensive, which was the largest Japanese ground offensive of World War II in 1944. He thought that he could stop them with air power alone, and he could not. And we end up having this big tactical defeat when every other theater is seeing success against the Axis. And that was in part due to him biting off too much and believing too much in what air power could accomplish.
You also delineate some of the difficulties in something that you alluded to a moment ago, and that was alliances between Chiang Kai-shek and Chenault, which was very strong, and the relationship between Stilwell and the communist Chinese led by Mao Zedong. It seems that the nationalist and the communist in China were not above playing off their American allies to position themselves better, not only during the war, but what they knew would happen eventually if they were able to defeat the Japanese.
Well, it turns out it's very complicated, and we didn't really have a good idea at the time. Without a doubt, there were some corruption problems and a lot of issues with the nationalist government that Stilwell was right to be alarmed about. But our formal alliance was with the nationalists. Our working with the communists was only ever on an ad hoc enemy of my enemy basis. Mm-hmm. That being said, one of the really interesting things that comes out of looking at these missing aircrew reports is that people at the grassroots level, be they nationalists, communists, or even people that are allegedly collaborating with the Japanese, all come together to rescue Americans. In fact, it's pretty crazy because if you look at it, for those that were declared missing on a combat mission in China, about 55% of them didn't survive the crash or bailout. And that's really consistent with the statistics that we see in occupied Europe. But what's crazy is that if you survived the crash or bailout in occupied Europe, you had about a 20% chance of a friendly underground organization getting you back to Allied control. In China, if you survived the crash or bailout, you had a 90% chance of being brought back to Allied control. And it didn't matter if you landed in communist territory, if you landed in Japanese territory, or if you landed in nationalist territory, those odds were 90%. Only 81 out of the 1,832 that were in my data set were captured by the Japanese, and most of them fell basically directly on top of Japanese troops.
I think that was one of the most interesting things about your book, actually, is the realization that the Chinese people appreciated so much the sacrifices that Americans were making fighting the Japanese in China and trying to help the Chinese overcome the Japanese who had invaded Manchuria years before. And in the Sino-Japanese War had been going on for some time. And also, this was not the first time that the Japanese and the Chinese had fought each other either. This was just the most significant war, the most destructive war they had fought against each other.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think that's one of the eye-opening things about this history is when you get down to it, when you look at the aggregate, yeah, there were a lot of problems in our alliance with the nationalists. There were a lot of issues between the United States and Mao Zedong's communists and some irreconcilable political differences. But at the grassroots level, for the average American airman who's trying to survive, there was not a better ally in the war than the average Chinese person that was willing to stick out their neck on their behalf. And the risks were very, very real to the Chinese. When you look at the Doolittle raid, for example, you have 15 out of the 16 crews plopped down in China on the East Coast there, unannounced, unanticipated. 65 of those guys were brought back safely to American control. And in the punitive campaign that follows, over 200,000 men, women, and children are slaughtered by Japanese troops as punishment for helping the Americans. And that was not uncharacteristic for the rest of the war.
Right.
They'd punish you, they'd punish your family, they'd punish your village, they'd punish your province. And what is remarkable is that 90% figure stays strong all the way through. So they knew the risks, and they did it anyways.
I think that is absolutely amazing. And I really wish that the people in China now were allowed to know the history of the relationship between the United States and China 80 years ago. Whenever we rattle sabers at each other or grimace at each other across the bamboo wall, I wish that the average citizen knew that there was a time when the United States and China were not just allies, but actually on friendly terms, and that they sacrificed themselves out of appreciation for what the Americans were doing. I just found that really, really interesting, and I never read that anywhere else, even in other books about the Flying Tigers. Talking, in case you're late joining us, to Daniel Jackson, a graduate of the Air Force Academy, a combat aviator, the author of The Forgotten Squadron, the 449th Fighter Squadron in World War II, and Famine, Sword, and Fire, The Liberation of Southwest China in World War II, and his brand new book, Fallen Tigers, The Fate of America's Missing Airmen in China During World War II. It's a Mitchell Institute book, Aviation Air Power, the series editor, Brian Lastly, and it's published by the University Press of Kentucky. We would be remiss if we did not mention that this theater involved Burma, of course, but it also involved Thailand. It also involved what would become Malaysia, Indochina, which would become Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. So all of Southeast Asia really is a part of what's going on here. Part of it is because the British, of course, still controlled India, although there were factions in India that were trying to ally themselves with the Japanese. The Japanese were promoting themselves as the great liberators of the colonized people, but the Thais and everybody else found out when the Japanese moved in, they were just swapping one colonizer for another. Tell us a little bit about the Thai fighters and the other pilots that were from these various people groups and nation states that were within Indochina.
Absolutely. It's very interesting because when you look at World War II in Asia, it really sets up the rest of the 20th century for the United States of America. And so it's always been interesting to me that more people don't study this part of the war. When you look at Vietnam, for example, Ho Chi Minh himself actually rescued a downed American pilot, personally escorted him all the way back to Kunming, and then used that to get, you know, a signed photo and some weapons from Claire Chennault,
right,
so he could consolidate his control over the Viet Minh. So these connections are super interesting, and they pervade this whole theater. You see, you run across so many familiar names that come up later in the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
and it just baffles me that that people don't know more about this, because the Vietnam War, the Korean War, they really all come from World War II in Asia.
Right.
And our present relationship with China is so deeply enmeshed in this history that we just don't make a habit of studying in the United States. Thailand is super interesting because it's the one, they claim to be the one Southeast Asian nation that wasn't colonized. And so they were actually a free nation when, on December 8th, Japan invaded them on their way to British-controlled Malaya. And Japan basically presents them with a choice, hey, join us, or we'll just continue this invasion. You know, several Thai airmen and soldiers had already died by this point in opposing the Japanese. And so the prime minister decides that his best bet is to throw in with the Japanese, not be occupied, even though they kind of were, but be an ally and then get out of the situation what they could. And so at various times, China-based airmen from the 14th Army Air Force, and even from the American Volunteer Group early in the war, are actually flying missions into Thailand to attack Japanese bases there. And actually, my personal connection to some of these stories is, you know, I'd gone to China to do some research and had actually been working on finding some of the guys that are still missing in action in China by coordinating with different Chinese groups that were there. And then in 2017, the trade war started, and I was suddenly uninvited for those things and haven't really found an opening since then. But when that door closed, another opened. I'd been corresponding for some time with the Royal Thai Air Force Museum, and during a flood in Bangkok, they had to relocate a bunch of their records and happened to find all these old police reports from police officers that had responded to these aircraft crashes. One of them was a reconnaissance aircraft that crashed in northern Thailand in a thunderstorm. And the other one was a P-51 Mustang that ended up in this dogfight with these Thai fighters and got shot down. and both pilots were still listed as missing in action. But suddenly we had, instead of these vague American reports, especially for the reconnaissance pilot, it was like, hey, somewhere on this 1,800-mile trip, this guy went missing. He just never came back because it was a single-ship mission. We had no idea where he was, and so he was just declared dead, you know, body unrecoverable. Both of them ended up being declared body unrecoverable. And so we took the specific information in these police reports, though, and we were able to actually go to northern Thailand, find eyewitnesses to these crashes, and actually find the crash sites. For the reconnaissance plane, we had an eyewitness that actually showed us where they buried the body of this guy. And then for the P-51, somebody actually took us up into the mountains. The guy was never buried. And in fact, one of the reasons that they didn't disturb the crash site is the locals thought it was haunted because his body wasn't properly disposed of in accordance with Buddhist practice. And so we walked up this mountain, you know, hacking our way through the jungle with machete up this ridiculous terrain until we actually came upon the crash site and found pieces of his P-51, like, on the mountainside where he crashed over 75 years ago. And so now the U.S. government is actually working with Thailand to recover both those sites, and hopefully they'll be able to bring back human remains and finally have them buried in the United States after more than 75 years of being missing in action.
There were a couple of things that I also found very interesting, that there were villages and cities where Americans were killed in combat and their planes crashed or their bodies were found, and the Chinese civilians built monuments to thank them. And you have a great story in here about Glenn Beneda. Mm-hmm. Being finally convinced to go back to China because they found his airplane. He finally goes, and when he gets to the village, it's a huge celebration on his behalf, and which he did not expect at all. And I found that delightful and remarkable.
Yeah, and it's so funny because he had all this shame that he was carrying for so long because he goes to war as a fighter pilot, ends up shot down by the Japanese in a dogfight. And so he saw himself as kind of a failure in that way, you know, and definitely not as anything special. And it took him a long time to get convinced to go back. He finally went back in 2005 and ended up at that site where he was shot down and ends up having this really emotional moment with the people that had rescued him and had just this epiphany of what all of this service meant. And it totally changed his life. You know, he died 5 years later, but for those 5 years, he just had a complete perspective change on his service in World War II after meeting those people and seeing the value that they put on him specifically and his service. It was really amazing. And there were monuments. So he is now memorialized in China. His ashes are actually interred in China. He died in 2010. But there are monuments to other folks, too, like Bob Mooney, who didn't bail out of his plane because he didn't want it to crash into a Chinese village in southwest China. He stayed with it and ended up dying. They built a monument to him. It had to be torn down during the Cultural Revolution, but they put it back up in the 90s, and his sister actually went out there and visited it. And so there are still several of those. In Nanjing, they actually have tablets that have the names of every American that was killed in China during the war to memorialize them. So there are memorials there, and there are people in China that work to keep that history alive because it's important to them, and because the politics are less important to them and the modern politics are less important to them than the individual sacrifices that they see as important to their village or their family or their province, etc.
That was such a heartwarming thing to learn. I had heard about what the Chinese people who hid the Doolittle Raiders, how backlash against them by the Japanese was horrendous and wildly over the top. And like you said before, they killed the people that helped. They killed their family. They killed their friends. They killed anybody that knew them. They wiped out the villages. They just obliterated entire villages to say, don't do this again, to find out that in lots of places in China where these guys were flying and went down, the Chinese people did it anyway, and not just for the Doolittle guys, but for all the airmen. And that's a great story.
Yeah, absolutely. It really is. Actually, one of my favorite stories is a guy that was hit by ground fire while strafing an airfield in Shanghai, which is like the epicenter of Japanese occupation. Mm-hmm. And his P-51 goes down 1 mile. He bails out 1 mile away from the enemy-occupied airfield. You know, these guys, the Japanese troops on the field, just shot him down. They watched his plane go down. They watched him bail out. They all pile into a truck to go roll him up. And by the time they go that 1 mile, he is already gone. The Chinese have given him peasant clothes. They've hidden him in a shed. And within minutes, they've got him on the back of an ox cart. It takes him like 2 months to make it back to Allied control. But he was out of there.
Yeah.
It's just remarkable. And these are just normal people.
Yeah.
Just regular people that respond immediately to make it happen.
It's really a great story. And, you know, there's so much about the war in Europe. And we hear about the French underground. I've been to Poland, and they're always kind of disappointed that we didn't know that the Polish underground was even bigger and more efficient than the French underground, for example. And this was what the Chinese were doing in those days. It's a great story. People wanted to find out more about the book and more about the topic of your book, Fallen Tigers. Do you have a website they could visit or anything like that?
I do. They can go to ForgottenSquadron.com. That's ForgottenSquadron.com. And I've got some of the raw interviews transcribed there for them to read. I've got the whole database there. They can actually search it, especially if they're looking for a specific individual or they want to search it by those killed, those missing. And by missing, I mean still listed as missing in action. The bodies haven't been found. So they can actually search that database there. They can see a database of all the American airfields in China as well. So there's a lot of information there. And then all three of my books are available on Amazon.com as well.
Excellent. Daniel Jackson, our guest today on the bookshelf, his new book, Fallen Tigers, The Fate of America's Missing Airmen in China During World War II. And it's from the University Press of Kentucky. Daniel, thank you so much for taking time to be with us. I appreciate it very much. And I look forward to your next book.
Thanks, Dave.
Our thanks again to Daniel Jackson, the author of Fallen Tigers, The Fate of America's Missing Airmen in China During World War II. It's from the University Press of Kentucky. You can check ForgottenSquadron.com to find out more. Thanks so much for joining us on The Bookshelf. And you can also check out the podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.